Hornbeckius.
In the Eastern churches, baptism was more anciently administered by immersing the whole body in water. Afterward, first in the Western churches, on account of the coldness of the countries, bathing being less in use than in the East, and the tender age of those that were baptized, dipping or sprinkling was admitted. Booth, Abridged, pages 100 and 101. Grotius. The custom of pouring or sprinkling seems to have prevailed in favor of those that were dangerously ill and were desirous of giving up themselves to Christ, whom others call clinics. See the Epistle of Cyprian to Magnus, Ibid, page 101. E. Spanhemius. In these northern and colder countries, out of regard to the tender age of infants, we use aspersion in place of immersion, which of old was usually practiced, either in open rivers or in private baptistries, and vessels filled with water. Ut supra. Bishop Burnett. The danger of dipping in cold climates may be a very good reason for changing the form of baptism to sprinkling. Ut supra. Dr. Towerson. The first mention we find of aspersion in the baptism of the older sort was in the case of the clinici, or men who received baptism upon their sick beds, and that baptism is represented by St. Cyprian as legitimate upon the account of necessity that compelled it, and the presumption there was of God's gracious acceptation thereof because of it, by which means the lawfulness of any other baptism than by immersion will be found to be in the necessity there may sometimes be of another manner of administering it. Ibid, pages 101 and 102. St. John Floyer. The Church of Rome hath drawn short compendiums of both sacraments. In the Eucharist they use only the wafer. Instead of immersion they introduced aspersion. Ibid, page 102. Schleusner, in defining baptisma, says, properly, immersion, dipping into water, a washing. Hence, it is transferred to the sacred rite which par excellence is called baptism, in which formerly those to be baptized were plunged into water. New Testament Lexicon. Stocius, in defining baptisma, says, specifically, properly it denotes the immersion or dipping of a thing into water that it may be cleansed or washed. Hence, it is transferred to designating the first sacrament of the New Testament which they call the sacrament of initiation, namely, baptism, in which those to be baptized were formerly immersed into water, though at this day the water is only sprinkled upon them. New Testament Lexicon. Formerly they were immersed, now they have water only sprinkled on them. How came the change? Dr. R. Witham. The word baptism signifies a washing, particularly when it is done by immersion or by dipping or plunging a thing under water, which was formerly the ordinary way of administering the sacrament of baptism. But the Church, which cannot change the least article of the Christian faith, is not so tied up in the matters of discipline and ceremonies. Not only the Catholic Church, but also the pretended Reformed churches, have altered this primitive custom in giving the sacrament of baptism, and now allow of baptism by pouring or sprinkling water on the person baptized. Booth, Abridged, pages 102 and 103. Moses Stuart. It will be seen from all this that Christians began somewhat early to deflect from the ancient practice of immersion. Stuart on Christian Baptism, page 175. In debate with J.S. Sweeney, Dr. J.B. Logan, an eminent Cumberland Presbyterian debater, said, "The Church claimed the right to change the mode, not the ordinance itself, and in that I agree with the Church and can cheerfully admit it." Sweeney and Logan debate, page 72. We have already quoted from Professor Stuart that aspersion and effusion, which now and then practiced in particular cases in primitive times, were gradually introduced. The fact that they were gradually introduced shows that they came not from the Lord. He says that these became at length quite common in the Western Church, but the mode of baptism by immersion the Oriental Church has always continued to preserve, even down to the present time. Stuart on Baptism, page 151. Delingius says, "The Greeks retain the right of immersion to this day, as Jeremiah the Patriarch of Constantinople declares." Booth on Baptism, Abridged, page 93. Budius. That the Greeks defend immersion is manifest and has been frequently observed by learned men, which Ludolphus informs us in the practice of the Ethiopians. Ut supra. Venema. In pronouncing the baptismal form of words, the Greeks used the third person, saying, Let the servant of Christ be baptized in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, and immerse the whole man in water. Ut supra. Other authorities might be given, but these are deemed sufficient to show that while the Western or Roman Catholic Church gradually introduced the practice of aspersion and effusion until they became common by the time of the Reformation, the Oriental or Greek Church has continued faithful to the commands of the Lord and still practices only immersion as baptism. As the Greeks are presumed to better understand the Greek language than others accustomed to speak it, the fact that they have always understood baptizo to mean immersion and have practiced accordingly is an item of no small importance in arriving at a knowledge of what the Lord required as baptism. If any people may be presumed to know the import of the word used by the Lord, it is certainly those by whom the Greek language has always been spoken. If they had not understood their national tongue, who has understood it? Professor Stewart quotes Calvin thus: "It is of no consequence at all whether the person baptized is totally immersed or whether he is merely sprinkled by an effusion of water. This should be a matter of choice to the churches in different regions, although the word baptize signifies to immerse. And the rite of immersion was practiced by the ancient church." And then says, "To this opinion I do most fully and heartily subscribe." Stewart on Baptism, pages 156 and 157. Thus we see that after conceding immersion to be the meaning of the word used by the Lord to indicate his will, and that immersion was the practice of the ancient church, these two great lights in the ranks of orthodoxy think it a matter of indifference, and should be left to the choice of the church. Hence, the church may decide whether the people shall obey the Lord or not. Kind reader, which will you obey? If the Lord be God, serve him. If Baal, serve him. But what are the reasons given by Professor Stewart for the conclusion to which he comes? 1. The rite in question is merely external. Suppose it is. Is that any reason why it should not be obeyed? Jewish circumcision was outward in the flesh, Romans 2 and verse 28, yet God said, "The uncircumcised man-child, whose flesh of his foreskin is not circumcised, that soul shall be cut off from his people. He hath broken my covenant." Genesis 17, verse 14. Does anyone believe that God would have excused a Jew from circumcision, or have justified him in changing the act to something else upon the ground that the rite was merely external? To obey is better than sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of rams. Professor Stewart argues the right of the church to change the act of baptism at great length with all the plausibility of an ingenious sophist, but we have room only for a few short extracts which we give as follows. Must I show that we are not at liberty without being justly exposed to the accusation of gross departure from Christianity to depart from the modes and forms of the apostolic church in any respect? I have shown that all the churches on earth do depart from these in their celebration of the Lord's Supper, and yet without any apprehension of being guilty of any impropriety, much less of being justly chargeable with the spirit of disobedience and revolt. But what is the case in respect to baptism? Will nothing but the letter do here? So you may think and reason, but are you not entirely inconsistent with yourself? Mere externals must be things of particular time and place. Dress does not make the man. One dress may be more convenient or more decorous than the other, but neither the one nor the other is an essential part of the person. So the common feeling of men has decided about most of the external matters pertaining to religion the world over. They have always been modified by time and place, by manners and customs, and they always will be. Accordingly, long before the light of the Reformation began to dawn upon the churches, the Roman Catholics themselves were gradually adopting the method of baptism by sprinkling or effusion, notwithstanding their superstitious and excessive devotedness to the usages of the ancient church. All this serves to illustrate how there sprang up, in the bosom of a church superstitiously devoted to ancient rites and forms, a conviction that the mode of baptism was the one adiaphora of religion, that is, something unessential to the rite itself and which might be modified by time and place without any encroachment upon the command itself to baptize. Gradually did this conviction increase until the whole Roman Catholic Church, that of Milan only excepted, admitted. By far the greater part of the Protestant world have also acceded to the same views. Even the English Episcopal Church and the Lutheran Church, both zealous in times past for what they supposed to be apostolic and really ancient usage, have had no difficulty in adopting modes of baptism quite different from that of immersion. Stuart on Baptism, pages 169 to 172. Thus we see that Professor Stuart thinks that the Church may change the forms and usages of worship just as a man may change his dress to suit time and place. He shows us, with an air of seeming pleasure, that the Roman Catholic Church had gradually left her devotedness to the usages of the ancient Church and adopted sprinkling and pouring, and that the Protestant churches had followed her example. Daniel prophesied of a power that should speak great swelling words against the Most High and think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until a time and times and the dividing of time. But the judgment shall sit, and they shall take his dominion to consume and to destroy it unto the end. Daniel chapter 7, verses 25 and 26. Does not the power assigned by Professor Stuart to the Church resemble that claimed by the government spoken of by Daniel? Though he seemed to triumph for a time, judgment came upon him in the end. Let us learn a lesson here, and not seek to change laws and times which God has arranged in accordance with his own will. Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he as God sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 3 and 4. The Pope of Rome has gone on from one act of usurpation to another, changed the act of baptism in accordance with his views of propriety, and has, finally, had himself proclaimed infallible, thus sitting in the temple of God and seeking to show himself that he is God. But Daniel said that a day of judgment would come that would break the power of the usurper, and we feel encouraged to hope that the day of his power is fast drawing to a close. Will Protestant parties continue to cling to the changes which he has made for them in divine law? Why call ye me Lord, Lord, and do not the things which I say? Luke 6, verse 46. If ye love me, keep my commandments. John 14 and verse 15. End of chapter 12.